Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Jackie Leonard, and in the early hours of Thursday, the 10th of October, these are our main stories. President Trump has described Turkey's military strike against Kurdish fighters in northeast Syria as a bad idea. There have been fresh clashes between protesters and riot police during a national strike in Ecuador over the government's decision to end fuel subsidies. And two people have been killed by a gunman who tried to break into a synagogue in the German city of Halle as Jews celebrated Yom Kippur. Also in this podcast, there's evidence to suggest that dogs can actually help you live longer. We begin at the Turkish-Syrian border. The sounds of jets taking off from Turkey's Diyarbakir base close to the Syrian border. President Trump has criticised Turkey's attack on Kurdish forces in northeastern Syria, describing it as a bad idea. The Turkish assault comes just days after Mr. Trump controversially withdrew American troops from the path of the offensive, appearing to give it a green light. Turkey says it's attacking militant positions, but a monitoring group says at least 10 civilians have been killed. Kurdish-led militias have been key US allies in the fight against the Islamic State group. President Trump said he was speaking to both Ankara and the Kurds.
We've told President Erdogan how we feel, but we are speaking to both sides and we're seeing what can be made out of a situation. But we have no soldiers in the area. You know, we're getting out of the endless wars. We have to do it. And eventually somebody was going to have to make the decision. And frankly, we're getting a lot of praise from that decision. People are saying, gotta sometime bring our people back home. We're really serving, and we were serving as a police force. We had defeated ISIS. We defeated the caliphate 100%.
The Turkish military launched the airstrikes and artillery fire on a string of Syrian border towns. Earlier, Ibrahim Kalin, a spokesman for the Turkish president, spoke to the BBC.
We're not going there to occupy Syria. We're not going there to attack civilians. And making such calls as mobilizing people to be human shields, where does responsibility lie? And who will be responsible for that? We will never attack the civilians.
Our international correspondent, Orla Girin, is on the Turkish side of the Syria-Turkey border.
We've had to pull back about an hour from the border because communications were being jammed in that area. That began as soon as the offensive began. Now, we have had confirmation from the Turkish Defence Ministry that the ground offensive is now taking place. And Turkey has moved incredibly swiftly with an operation from the air and on the ground, a unilateral action by a NATO nation that has been widely condemned. It has caused alarm in the European Union. It has been described by President Trump as a bad idea. But of course, many will point out that President Trump himself has helped pave the way for all this. The Americans withdrew some of their special forces who were on the border here. That gave a very clear signal to President Erdogan that he could proceed. America denies it was the green light, but it has certainly been read that way by the Syrian Kurdish forces who are now under attack. And already tonight, we are starting to receive reports from inside Syria and from monitoring groups about civilian casualties, and we are being told that at least 10 Syrian civilians have been killed. Now, Britain has joined the countries expressing serious concern. It has said that this unilateral Turkish action risks not only destabilizing the region, but also undermining the progress that has been made against Islamic State in Syria.
That was Orla Girin on the Turkish-Syrian border. And as she mentioned, European leaders have reacted with alarm to the Turkish offensive. The European Commission President Jean-Claude Juncker urged Ankara to stop, saying the EU would not pay for any safe zone. France, Germany and Britain have asked for a meeting of the United Nations Security Council. NATO's Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg said the Turkish operation should not jeopardise the gains made so far in the fight against IS.
It is important to avoid actions that may further destabilize the region, escalate tensions, and cause more human suffering. I count on Turkey to act with restraint and ensure that any action it may take in northern Syria is proportionate and measured. We must not jeopardize the gains we have made together against our common enemy, ISIS, because ISIS continues to pose a grave threat to the Middle East and North Africa and to all our nations.
In the United States, the Republican Senator Lindsey Graham urged President Trump to change course. Our World Affairs correspondent Paul Adams has this assessment of the Turkish motivation behind its military offensive.
I think the overriding concern for Turkey is to take on the Syrian Kurdish militia, the YPG, which Turkey regards as synonymous with the Turkish Kurdish group, the PKK, which both Turkey and the West regard as a terrorist organization. So that is the principal concern. They want to limit the YPG's influence, to keep them well away from the border, and ideally to destroy them. Now, President Erdogan has a secondary concern here, which is to attempt to relieve the burden on Turkey posed by as many as 4 million Syrian refugees who have sought shelter there during this long, dreadful Syrian war. The problem is that the refugees he is thinking of resettling are not from that part of Syria at all. They're from other parts of Syria. And frankly, it's illegal to resettle refugees in this way. So we don't yet know exactly how or even if he's going to go about doing that.
And this onslaught comes just a few days after the United States' decision to withdraw troops from the region. There has been condemnation in the US from both Democrats and Republicans. And President Trump has actually tweeted about it today, hasn't he?
He's both tweeted about it and released a statement. And I think the statement is probably the one that's worth focusing on. And in it, he says that the United States will hold Turkey to its commitment to protect civilians, protect religious minorities, including Christians, and ensure no humanitarian crisis takes place. In addition, according to Mr. Trump, Turkey is now responsible for ensuring that all IS fighters being held captive remain in prison and that ISIS does not reconstitute in any way, shape or form.
That was Paul Adams. On to other stories now. At least two people have been killed in an anti-Semitic attack in the German city of Halle. A gunman tried to get into a local synagogue where up to 80 worshippers had gathered for Yom Kippur, the holiest day in the Jewish calendar. Here's Jenny Hill.
Calmly, deliberately, in broad daylight, a man dressed in combat clothes aimed a shotgun and fired down a quiet city street. Amateur footage captured the attack outside a synagogue in Halle. The man, who's believed to be a German in his late 20s, tried and failed to shoot his way into the building. Eyewitnesses say he threw at least one grenade into the synagogue's cemetery before shooting a woman dead on the street. He then attacked a nearby kebab shop, killing a man inside. He wore a head camera and streamed the footage online.
That was Jenny Hill in Germany. This week, European Union countries are proposing a new joint scheme to share more evenly the migrants and refugees who arrive in Europe by sea. Last year, Spain saw the biggest influx, with about 60,000 people reaching its shores. In response, the EU and Spanish governments struck a multi-million-dollar deal with Morocco to try to curb illegal migration. But human rights campaigners say they're worried the new measures may be leading to abuses. Tim Smith reports.
I'm standing on a boat in the Western Mediterranean between Spain and Morocco. The number of people crossing these waters has decreased dramatically in the last year. But while numbers crossing the sea have fallen, concerns are emerging about how migrants and refugees are being treated inside Morocco. I'm travelling to Melilla, one of the EU's few land borders with Africa.
We're right in front of border fences, three Spanish fences and one Moroccan fence on the other side, and a ditch in the middle.
This is Diego Fernandez Maldonado. He's a lawyer from the Jesuit Service for Immigrants, who works with people arriving in Melilla. He's concerned about the impact of this investment into Morocco's border forces.
In terms of the conditions that migrants live in the surroundings of Melilla, Moroccan forces will try to apply as much measures as possible to avoid entries. This can translate to more violence against migrants on the other side of the border, to having them living in very poor conditions. We have unofficial camps of migrants who are seeking to enter Europe, and we have observed that these conditions continue to worsen. That has a direct relation with the investment in Moroccan police, equipment, willingness, whatever you want to call it, for sure.
Despite Morocco's ramped-up efforts to stop the flow of migration into Europe, many are still attempting to scale the 6-metre-high fences that separate Spain and Africa. This recording shows the elation of 150 people who managed to climb the barrier to reach Spanish territory in August this year. But not everyone gets so lucky. This is Assad, 22 years old from Iraq. He says he was forced to flee his home when he received threats to his life after converting to Sunni Islam. Eventually he reached Morocco before trying to climb the fence to get to Spanish territory.
I tried one time to make it over the wall, but I fell and broke two of my teeth. The police saw me injured, and when I gave my passport and they realized I was Iraqi, they beat me. I've tried around 30 times to cross. Every time they have caught me, they beat me. One time, when they took my passport, they put me in a room, and there was an officer in plain clothes who beat me so badly that I couldn't move for a week.
We reached out to the Moroccan and Spanish governments, who declined to directly respond to concerns over human rights abuses. Maya Kosianchich is the European Union's spokesperson for foreign affairs and security policy.
The European Union stands for human rights. In Morocco specifically, there is a number of programs that is focused on the protection of migrants and their rights. As with any support that is a long-term support, there is a certain period of time that is needed for measures like training that they can actually take place. We are convinced that the results will follow.
Looking out from Melilla's coastline, with its border fortifications reaching out into the Mediterranean, it's possible to see a plan that is working for the EU. Since the injection of funds, the number of people arriving in Spain via North Africa this year has more than halved. But many people who've experienced the country's enhanced border forces say that these changes are already having a very real human cost.
That report was by Tim Smith. Three scientists have been awarded the 2019 Nobel Prize in Chemistry for the development of lithium-ion batteries. John Goodenough, Stanley Whittingham and Akira Yoshino share the prize for their work on this rechargeable technology, which powers portable electronics used by billions of people every day. Here's our science correspondent, Pallab Ghosh.
The rechargeable batteries that power our phones and computers have their origins in the 1970s, when oil prices rose sharply and nations invested in finding alternative energy sources. Professor Whittingham was the first to harness the potential of lithium while working for the US oil company Exxon. Professor Goodenough made the technology more efficient, and Professor Yoshino made it safe to use. The batteries are now ubiquitous since they became commercially available in 1991. With further research, their capacity should increase, enabling them to store surplus power produced by renewable energy sources, such as solar, wind and wave power technologies. Professor Goodenough, who did much of his research at Oxford University, was asked why he thought it had taken the Nobel Committee so long to recognise his achievement.
I haven't the slightest idea. And all I can say is I didn't ever lobby for or look forward to this particular day, but I'm very happy that it's arrived. It's been very nice to receive a recognition, yes.
Professor Goodenough is 97, the oldest person to have received the Nobel Prize. He's still active in his research, as are his fellow winners, who are in their 70s. Indicating perhaps that the three battery scientists seem to be as durable and rechargeable as the technology they developed.
That was Pallab Ghosh. Now, some details of another podcast from the BBC World Service.
Dr. Ruja promised to make the world rich.
We create the world around this coin.
Her company made billions from global investors.
She called herself the Crypto Queen.
And then, 2 years ago, she disappeared.
How can this happen?
Join me, Jamie Bartlett, as I search for Dr. Ruja and the truth about her company, OneCoin.
Kidnapping, killing.
It starts to get very scary, very, very fast.
The Missing Crypto Queen. Find it wherever you get your podcasts.
Now to Ecuador, and in some of the worst unrest in years, further clashes have been taking place across the country between protesters and security forces. Police fired tear gas as thousands of people took to the streets in the capital, Quito, and gathered near the presidential palace. The protesters, led by indigenous groups, are demanding an end to austerity and the return of fuel subsidies. President Lenin Moreno has imposed a night curfew near government buildings. We heard more from Matias Sibel of BBC Mundo, who's in Quito.
Everything started, you know, someone threw a stone at the police through tear gas. And we've been doing this for the last 2 hours. Little micro battles all around the center of Quito.
Was the general strike widely observed?
The general strike tried a lot of things. You know, when the protest started 1 week ago, the main objective was the end of the austerity measures. But now I was talking with the people, especially with the indigenous people, and they are really, we can say, fed up with the president. They are fed up of the state of emergency. They are fed up of the curfew. They are fed up with the repression that they suffered yesterday in front of the National Assembly. They don't think it's enough that the president take a step back with austerity measures. They want the president to step down. They say they don't trust the president anymore. It doesn't help either that the president left the capital city a couple of days ago and went to another city. The main slogan at the moment is Moreno fuera, which means Moreno out.
And in the meantime, the police and the army remain loyal to Mr. Moreno, do they?
Yes, they remain loyal. I saw some army personnel a couple of minutes ago, and they are trying to avoid the protest getting into the center of the presidential palace. So at the moment, the military looks like they will not take any political step. But a lot of things depend on how this day is going to finish.
That was Matias Sibel of BBC Mundo in Ecuador. A row between Egypt and Ethiopia over the damming of the River Nile has escalated after recent talks between the two countries failed to make any progress. In Parliament, Egypt's foreign minister accused Ethiopia of ignoring an agreement and going ahead with plans to fill the Renaissance Dam. Will Ross has the details.
Egypt's great concern is how long Ethiopia is going to take to fill up the Renaissance Dam's vast reservoir. Ethiopia says it could take less than 3 years, but as a concession has proposed taking longer, between 4 and 7 years. But Egypt's still worried and wants the process slowed right down if there's a drought. It now fears the government in Addis Ababa is going to go ahead and fill the dam at its own pace. In Parliament, the Egyptian Foreign Minister, Sameh Shoukry, described this as an unacceptable move that would affect the stability of the region.
That was Will Ross. Now, a story about sickle cell disease and a young woman from London called Siliano Kwelu. Earlier this week, she posted a video of herself in hospital receiving treatment for the condition. It's now been watched by more than 1.8 million people. The World Health Organization defines sickle cell as a group of inherited health conditions where the normal round shape of red blood cells become like crescent moons. These cells can interconnect, resulting in blood clots, which can lead to extreme pain in the back, chest, hands, and feet. The condition is particularly common in people with an African or Caribbean family background, and approximately 5% of the world's population carries the trait. It was when Siliana shared a very painful and honest moment in hospital that got so many people talking. Divya Arya asked her how she was.
I'm nervous, I'm shy, I'm worried. There's a lot.
But I have to say, you're here because along with me, 1.8 million people have watched that little clip you put out on Twitter. And when I watched it, in fact, why don't we hear it once more? It just stunned me, the pain that came through, and we couldn't even see you. The video is shot from behind.
Yeah.
Even without looking at you, it was literally just hearing you.
Yeah.
In that pain.
Yeah.
What had happened at that time?
So in that day, we decided to go to the cinema and we watched Halloween, the movie. And even in the cinema, because the temperature is quite low, I think that triggered it. That was the first trigger. And because it was a horror movie, I think because I was so excited, like I was stressed, I was feeling nervous, I was jumpy in my seat. I think that also brought the crisis on. I said, look, let's just go to the hospital. And I was with my cousin at the time who's in the video. So when I came in, they were already waiting on me. I was still crying for, I would say, like an hour before I was actually given any medication, any pain calmer.
You had that much pain?
That much pain.
And you've been crying for an hour?
For an hour.
That's horrendous.
Yeah.
And that can happen any day?
Any day, anytime, anywhere. And it's unpredictable.
You're just going to see a film.
I know.
So what do you have to keep in mind?
You have that thing.
You plan your days, for example.
You always have that feeling of like something's going to happen to you. On the edge, constantly. You're always worried what's going to happen to me next.
And what do you do then? What are the things you kind of take care of that would not put you in that situation, not trigger this on?
I mean, stress plays a very, very big part in it. So I try my very, very best to stay calm, even though with the condition, you will be anxious, you will be nervous, you will be scared. But I just try to tell myself, like, it's okay, let's take the day, an hour by hour, minute by minute, day by day. But there is ways as well that you can help yourself, like wearing like more layers, drinking a lot of water, taking your medication, take your time, relax, you know, take it easy.
So when the pain triggers, what's it like? I mean, how can you help me understand the level of that pain?
So the pain is different all the time and there's different degrees. So in the video and the audio that we all heard, that is maximum degree. Hence why I'm screaming, my voice is breaking, and the pain comes in like a hammer being hit at you, at your bones, constantly. Someone hitting you at full force, or someone hitting you with a bat, knives digging into your muscles, into your bones. It feels like the worst pain ever.
And what would you do when that pain triggers?
You can't do anything. Your body is in shock.
Do regular painkillers help, or do you have like special medicine for it?
Okay, so there is special medicine and there's regular painkillers that you can take, but your body also becomes immune to it. That is what's bad about this whole sickle cell thing, because I've had this for 21 years.
You've had it since birth?
Since birth.
And it is hereditary?
Yes.
So your parents also have it?
My parents have the trait. They're carriers of the trait, but they don't have any effects. Even though if you do have the trait, sometimes it can be common for you to have some symptoms. My mom, my father, they don't have any symptoms at all. I've got the full disease, the full thing.
And does it go away? Does it come down with time?
No, it doesn't. For every person, it's very different. For me, I have the extreme case. Mine's very severe. And this year was the worst. But there had been times that for 2 years, I never felt pain. I was fine completely. But just this year, just flared up.
Ciliana Coelho. And if you want to find out more about sickle cell and where you can find support information, just go to the BBC Action website. Dogs. They provide companionship, warmth, a constant source of hair to augment your sofa cushions. But aside from those undoubted benefits, can they actually help you live longer? The evidence is mounting, as Jonathan Savage reports.
There is nothing quite like the sound and sight of a happy, panting dog welcoming you home from a hard day at work. Your stresses are washed away with every loving lick of that warm, floppy tongue. Too much? Well, maybe. But a study published in the American Heart Association's journal has found that dog ownership is associated with longer life. They've aggregated the results of prior research to come to this conclusion. For example, dog owners are 31% less likely to die from a heart attack or stroke. People who've already had a heart attack are 65% less likely to die early. The exact reasons require further research, but the best understanding is that pets make us more active and less stressed. So when your dog is bothering you for more walkies, she's only looking out for your health.
Jonathan Savage and his yappy little friend. And that's it from us for now. I'm off to the dog shelter to look for a little friend of my own, but there will be an updated version of the Global News podcast for you later. If you would like to comment on this edition or the topics we've covered in it, you know what to do. Send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Jackie Leonard, and until next time, goodbye.